You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you once again for joining us. And if this is your first time, please make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, lasting health, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I am grateful to have met and worked with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, you can all do me a big favor. Please check out some of our past shows at answersforthefamily.com to hear some informative and entertaining guests, as well as some dynamic co-hosts, as they discuss ways for you and your loved ones to become happier, healthier, and more at peace. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassadors who will work to bring us more listeners by just forwarding at least one of our shows to your social media group or to someone you know that can greatly benefit from a particular show. I want you to know that I truly appreciate it, and this is just another way that we, together, can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, as many of you have grown to expect, and I want you to know that it is always my pleasure to say that with us is my incredible co-host, international speaker, author, and kindness expert, Gabriella Von Rey. Gabriella, where in the world are you?
How are you?
I'm good. So while you're on your journey, where has it taken you today?
Well, I am in the Palm Desert area because I will be here for the next 2 weeks because I am writing my fourth book. So basically off the road for these last week and these two coming weeks to work. To keep my nose to the ground.
So do we get a little bit of a sneak peek on what the next book is going to be about?
Yeah, the sneak peek is that the next book is on kindness. Ta-da! because funny enough, I have never written a book on kindness. And so it is, the beginning is answering all the questions that people ask me on the road. And out of these questions, I actually fill in stories of my own life and the lives of others that I have met that people can find different ways to be kind. So, for example, we'll talk at a certain point about kindness to self. And then there will be a story about how someone either taught that to me or I saw it in someone else, and the story will explain better what kindness to self would look like.
Well, I love it. And I sort of guessed that it was going to be something about all of the things that you've learned from your 2-year journey on your Dare to Be Kind movement. So I think that's great. I'm looking forward to it. And so here for the next couple of weeks, are you going to be in the Los Angeles area so that you'll be able to be in studio for one of these shows?
I think I will be in studio in August, but not before that.
Okay. All right.
But I will definitely do my best, but it will be more like the third week of August. And then I'm really headed out. I'm headed out to Oregon. I'm trying to think of the states in that corner. Sorry, Oregon, Washington State, Idaho, Montana. There you go. It came out.
Oh, that's actually a good time to head north. So if anybody's out there and you're listening, and if you are the person either in charge of deciding who's going to be a speaker, or you want to bring to that person to their attention who you think would be a speaker, who better than to have somebody in to talk about kindness and how it starts right in your own backyard? So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So you can go to the Dare to Be Kind movement, and you know, and contact Gabriella there, or where else can they contact you?
Through Facebook, I am available everywhere. We have kind-team@daretobekindmovement.com email. It's really easy to get to us.
All right.
And we do interviews. We will speak at your schools, your universities, and your corporates. So let us know.
There you go. Now, and one of the things that within the movement that Gabriella talks about a lot is start this out, and as I said, in your own backyard, but I mean, within a 2-mile radius of yourself. Okay. If you start from there and you start to spread it out, well, in regards to our topic today, there is one place where you can start kindness, and that is right in your own relationship. How about starting with your own spouse? So, our topic today, and which is also the title of our guest's new book, is Living in Sin, Making Marriage Work Between I Do and Death. So with that said, our guest, since 2002, has served as a pastor of churches in New Jersey and Virginia, as well as a prison and hospital chaplain. Jason Michelli has earned degrees from the University of Virginia and Princeton Theological Seminary, and has been the executive pastor at Aldersgate United Methodist Church in Alexandria, Virginia, for almost 13 years. Now, Jason has performed dozens of weddings when he was diagnosed with incurable cancer, and suddenly his own marriage and his struggles to live up to its potential came into sharp relief and reality. Now, he started a blog called The Tamed Cynic in June of 2012. Since then, he has added a podcast called Crackers and Grape Juice, and as well as a solo and collaborative writing projects with different publishers, including author of Cancer is Funny, Keeping Faith in Stage Serious Chemo. Now, Jason's wife, Allie, is his high school sweetheart. And there's a quote by Jason that I believe is both charming and it made me smile. And that quote was, he said that after saying that he first met Allie on the swim team, he said, "One look at me in my Speedo and she was a goner," adding that she's his better 3/4 in everything except cooking. So Jason further describes his family as, "My youngest son, Gabriel, is a budding stand-up comedian who loves swimming and the White Stripes. His oldest son, Alexander, is a hardcore swimmer and gifted in everything but common sense," which is interesting. And in describing himself, he said that his menopause is such that he now cries at movies like The Blind Side, and as strongly as he believes in everything, he thinks baseball is the platonic ideal, something I'd love for him to expand upon for us, and it also makes me want to attend a game with him. So with that said, Jason, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks for having me. It sounds a lot more interesting listening to you than I do in real life.
Well, having had a chance to read your book, as well as being able to listen to your podcast, I think what people are going to find out is that you are very unique, very interesting, and you have a tendency to be able to look at life. And for those that are watching on Facebook Live, I'll just tilt my head a little bit and go kind of like this. So. So with that said, give us a little bit about your background. Share with our listeners so they get an idea of what brought you to this point.
You've already kind of covered some of it. I didn't grow up in the church, religious at all. And my parents own stop and go marriage, and my father's addictions were such that as a teenager I was getting pretty cynical in unhealthy ways, and one Christmas Eve my mom just announced that she was forcing us all to go to church, and that kind of skipped the record of our life. But you know, it took against my will, and so I had this kind of profound spiritual experience late in my teenage years, and I went to college and discovered that I liked thinking and talking and writing about it intellectually as well. And so I ended up going to graduate school to keep on pursuing that, and they told me I had to work in a church as part of the program, and I was like, what? And but I did it, and I discovered that I liked it and that people could tolerate me most Sundays. And so I ended up doing that, and yeah, I married my high school sweetheart. We met on the swim team in high school, and she's a lawyer here in D.C., and we have two boys, and so that's who we are. A few years ago, I woke up from emergency abdominal surgery after about 6 months of really uncomfortable and excruciating pain, and I woke up from surgery being told that they had removed an 11 by 11 inch tumor out of my intestine, and that they were waiting for results, but I likely had one of five rare cancers. And so my first book, Cancer's Funny, documents that experience in a year of intense chemo. I have something called mantle cell. It's in my marrow. It won't ever go away, but I feel fine now, and I do maintenance chemo one day a month. And so my new book, Living in Sin, is about the stress that was put on my marriage after, you know, thinking I was going to die and then getting a reprieve and suddenly feeling as though I needed to measure up to the expectations that miracle brought into our lives.
Now, I mentioned a little bit in regards to your wife. Share a little bit about her. And you know, there's a lot of things that I'm sure that we go through when we're told that we have something that is incurable. How did she handle it, and how did she help you through the early stages of that?
You know, I would say that it's funny because, you know, I've done hundreds of weddings, and before I got sick, one of my tropes that I liked to beat with couples before they got married was that you never know who it is you're marrying until after you've married them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and largely I think that's true. And I think it's true too, because, you know, marriage in a lot of ways is the process by which you discover the stranger that you call you. And so of course you don't know who it is you're marrying, because you don't even really know who you are until your spouse reveals that to you. And so I still believe that, but I think what I discovered when I got sick was that I did, in important ways, I did know who Allie was. You know, we don't use the word constancy very much in talking about virtues, but she is a constant, humble person. And so I knew how she would react, and I knew that she was up for the challenge before us. You know, I was, you know, like the hardest thing I imagine it was having to tell our boys what was the matter with me. And I was unconscious when she did that. I knew, not to get too heavy, but I knew when I was marrying her that I was marrying someone who could help me die potentially.
Wow.
That's interesting that you say that, if I may intervene here. What does that mean for the listener? I think I understand what you're saying there.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that, in my words, I would say you're saying that she was solid, that she's not someone that would run away from the task at hand. Am I correct there?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the wedding service itself, the last line of the vow is until we are parted by death. And I think, you know, sometimes we think of that in terms of like a timeline until the end. But I think what the wedding ritual is getting at is, you know, sickness, health, death, that like all of these things are going to come, and you're marrying someone who will help steward you through those experiences. I mean, as a pastor, I have seen any number of married couples go through illness, unemployment, loss of a child, addiction, and you know, there's certain crises that, you know, the stress is such that it splits the marriage up. You know,
but sometimes
and that happens.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and so in Living in Sin, I tell the story of my uncle Jim, who got leukemia around the same age when I was about the same age as my boys are now, and I remember him going through the process of being strong and vigorous, and then looking like I did when I was sick, and I remember how his wife handled that by having an affair with their grief counselor, and so. I went through my experience of being ill kind of, with that in the back of my head, but I knew that Allie's character was such that, I didn't have to worry about that.
Okay.
Super. You're mentioning in regards to weddings and that. So here, first of all, you have this diagnosis, but at the same time you are now, bringing people into their own union. And one of the things that you mention in the book that you state that weddings are the worst time and place for giving advice. Why is that?
The way I like to tell couples is that two people in love should never be making any sort of life altering decisions. It's precisely when you're in love that you are most likely to delude yourself, and make a bad decision. And part of what makes marriage and weddings a beautiful leap of faith is that there's absolutely no way you're going into it sober-minded, and yet you're willing to do it. I think that's, I put it in the book that what's interesting about the vows that bride and groom make to each other is that the ancient wedding ritual doesn't seem to care one way or the other about how they feel about each other. It doesn't ask them to talk about their emotions for each other. It doesn't even talk about them loving one another, really. It's just, given the fact that you're in love, and assuming that sickness and, poverty and all of these other sorts of things might come your way, what do you propose to do about each other? So marriage really is the experience of what you do with another when neither one of you knew what you were doing. When you said I do.
So do you also do premarital counseling?
I do. Yeah. Usually, 3 or 4 sessions with couples. And that's, and I usually try to beat them over the head that, I don't care how you feel about each other. Please don't tell me how much you love each other. None of that matters. It's really just, what are you going to do with each other when you discover that, the person you said I'd do to is no longer that person. Because that's inevitable because, our life lived with another person changes us.
So what advice do you give? So let's say that we've got a bunch of people out there right now that are listening, that are in love and they're thinking about planning their wedding and they're excited and they're in this new relationship. What do you tell them without sort of bursting their bubble?
I do everything I can to burst their bubble. One of the ways I put it in the book, is that, we all are products of the romantic age. And I think that's really unhelpful. And so I quote a French philosopher in the book, who says that expectations are the enemies of love. Because our expectations prevent us from dealing with the person who's before us. And I think oftentimes our expectations, we experience them personally as accusations, and those accusations can then produce unhelpful and unhealthy behaviors in us. And so I do try to burst their bubble. I try to shear away as many of their unhelpful expectations as possible. I let them know, and this is advice. I let them know that, the practice of marriage requires them to, anticipate having to say, I do 10 years, 20 years, whenever, when the person they've married is no longer that person. And so, you have to enter marriage with the intentionality of recommitting to the person as life has made them, somewhere down the road, probably multiple times. And then another thing, we talk about love, I mean, it's interesting that we all understand that love is passive, and how we you know, speak of it and sing about it, like it happens to us.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, seldom do we stop to think, you know, how is it produced in us? You know, and I heard you guys talking about kindness at the beginning of the show, and you know, kindness and love, like these emotions, like, you know, from a Christian perspective, at least, these emotions, these are things that we don't decide to go and do, right? We don't decide to go and be kind so much as kindness is called up in us by the kindness of another.
Mm-hmm.
And love is produced in us by the, you know, the undeserved love of another. And so, you know, one bit of advice I give couples, and one of the reasons why I insist that at least the people I marry are, you know, of the same faith, is that, you know, a lot of times marriage is a one-way affair. You know, and so you have to believe in the ability of your forgiveness and mercy to produce in the other person feelings of love. And that means you have to be willing to give out forgiveness and give out grace and mercy, you know, even in the absence of merit.
Can I ask you something, Jason? How many...
You can ask me anything.
Okay, how many modern young people change a little bit the normal rituals with in the ceremony? I know there are two that strike me as a little bit old, in the sense that the one that says that you have to obey, and the other one that says until death do us part. Do most couples still leave those two in? And if so, do you ever get a request of couples to take those two out?
I sometimes get requests for people to change them. I always caution them that the chances of them outdoing, say, you know, a poet like Thomas Cranmer is pretty low. And it's best to go with, you know, what the wisdom of the saints has produced for you. The language about obey actually isn't in the traditional wedding rite. I don't know where that language came from, and I don't know why it pops up into so many weddings and movies and TV shows.
Yeah.
But the line about death is definitely there. And I think that's a helpful reminder to people, that the sheer limitedness of our days is a gift. And I think it allows, you know, that, you know, artists talk about how they can produce a more beautiful work of art with a small canvas. And I think understanding our days as numbered, helps us to appreciate them with another.
Now, one of the things that I have heard in many of the weddings now that I've been to is that last line of "as long as you both shall live" has been changed to "as long as you both shall love." What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have heard that too. That's why I asked, mm-hmm. Alan.
Yeah. So I'm just curious in regards to that, because I have some thoughts kind of both ways on that, but I'm curious as, Jason, your thoughts on that, and if you've been asked that particular change.
Yeah, I hate that. and
somehow I had a feeling.
I hate it, and I think, you know, I'm confident if you can talk to most married couples that they would be able to call that BS as well. I think you know, because what marriage is the declaration that no matter what happens, I'm not going anywhere. And it's exactly that sort of unconditional promise that produces the love. And so to say "as long as we both shall love" gets the order of operations wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, that for Christians, at least, it's the experience of grace given to us by another in the absence of any sort of deserving that produces love in us. And so to insist on love first as the condition, I think it turns our relationships into transactions. And I know, I mean, it happens in my own marriage. We're all born scorekeepers and bookkeepers. And to insist that love be, you know, the assumed starting point at all times is just inviting us to keep score with our spouse, which is just a recipe for disaster.
Okay. But didn't you say that love had nothing to do with it in the beginning? Didn't you say that words were very, you know, that we're not asking about the emotions of the person, that all the vows are basically based on, none of the vows are based on unconditional love?
Yeah, no, it's
so it sounds contradictory there, what you just said.
What the marriage ritual is about is it's the unconditional promise of sticking with the other. And it's, you know, and that promise then produces love in us. And of course, like brides and grooms, of course they're in love. But that's not the really interesting thing from my perspective.
Yeah. And what I hear you saying is that yes, they're going into this in love, but there's going to be times in which through various stresses or concerns or whatever, that we're going to be not the most lovable person at some particular point. And how do you push through that? How do you make sure that whatever it is that is making you feel this way at this point, that you can get past that and stay within a deeper level of love? Is that kind of what I hear you say?
Yeah. So, I mean, not to get, you know, overly Christian about it, but, you know, Christians understand marriage as, you know, a sacrament or a sort of a parable of how God loves us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the way God loves us, you know, grace is that, you know, while we were in no way deserving, and actually deserving of the opposite, God reveals God's love to us in Christ. And so, you know, like what marriage is a testimony to is that, you know, there's going to be plenty of days with your spouse where you deserve the opposite of love, where your pettiness, where your sinfulness, where your, you know, conceitedness, what have you, is going to be revealed by your life lived with your spouse. And yet your spouse is going to love you anyway. And that kind of receiving that undeserved love is actually what that's the engine of a healthy marriage, is what I'm trying to say in the book. So, you know, and so conflict in a marriage is actually like, you know, cause couples, as soon as conflict happens, because, you know, they enter marriage thinking that it's their in-loveness that makes their marriage good. And then as soon as conflict happens, they think something must be wrong, when in fact it's the opposite. The conflict means, you know, the shadow side to yourself is being revealed to the other, and it's producing conflict in the same way that two kind of rocks in a tumbler, you know, are rubbing against each other to produce something more beautiful. And so conflict is a good thing because, you know, it is, you know, your warts are being exposed, and yet you are loved even in those less flattering ways. You know, and it's that produces a loving marriage.
And we have a listener question that has come in, and it touches on how people deal with when they're going through something, again, like cancer, and sometimes how they lash out, or that they, you know, they become, you know, more difficult, I guess, to be with. And this listener question reads, some people who become ill don't always handle it well. My dear friend's husband, who was diagnosed with prostate cancer, became so negative and a huge challenge to be around, even for friends. Now that he is in remission, she has decided to leave the marriage. He says it is because the cancer may return, when in fact it has everything to do with his attitude and behavior. I know she still loves him. So do you think your book might help him wake up or help them? And thank you for so much for tackling this really tough discussion. And this is from Brenda in North Carolina.
That's a great question. And, you know, not knowing the whole story, my guess is, because I know it's true in my own marriage, and I talk about it in the book. You know, the Bible has this strange word called cleave, that has two contradictory meanings. And so to cleave means to join to. And so, like, you know, bride and groom were joining together and creating a new family. You know, but it also means to cut away from. And the idea there is that, you know, we're cutting away from our families of origin. And I think the wisdom in that is that all of us, we truck into our marriages, you know, the families where we grew up. And that means we bring into our marriage all sorts of habits, both good and bad. And mm-hmm. oftentimes what happens in stressful situations like a serious illness is the, you know, is the stress of that experience. It exposes the, you know, habits and whatnot, habits and wounds and scabs, you know, that we bring into our marriage that maybe we weren't aware of yet. And so my guess is, you know, in Brenda's situation there is that experience of illness exacerbated and exposed, you know, fault lines that were already present in the marriage. You know, and the reality is oftentimes, once those get exposed, it's beyond repair. You know, and so I think one thing my book would do as far as help is encourage people to be as honest and open and authentic about their true selves and the true state of their marriage, wherever they're at in that moment. Because I think it has to start there.
Jason, you have a quote that I've heard you speak as well as in the book, where it says, "Dodging death may not come as a disappointment, but it can reveal the many ways you are a disappointment." Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take a break, but when we come back, can you tell us a little bit about what it is you mean by that?
Sure.
All right. Mm-hmm. So for everybody out there, you're listening to Answers for the Family. We will be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest is Jason Michelli, and we are talking about making marriage work between I do and death. And with us also is my wonderful guest co-host, Gabriella Von Ray.
Oh, okay, sorry. I guess this was my cue. You asked the question of Jason before the commercial, which I really love too, Jason. Dodging death may not come as a disappointment, but it can reveal the many ways you are a disappointment. What does that mean?
Yeah, so the image I used in the book is the story of Lazarus, the guy who, for whatever reason, Jesus decided to take his sweet time getting to him, who had fallen ill. And so by the time Jesus gets there, he's dead, dead 3 days. And Jesus calls him out of the grave, still stinking of death, is what the Bible story says. And so, you know, I think what gospel is getting at there is that the Lazarus who has been reclaimed from death is still the same Lazarus who died. You know, and what I'm getting at there is, you know, sometimes when you have something like incurable cancer hit you, and you think you're going to die and you don't. You're so excited and you make a bucket list, which is exactly what I did. And I, you know, that's how my last book, Cancer is Funny, ended, was me making this bucket list. And, you know, you're going to make all of these commitments about being a whole new person, and you're going to do this and that, and your relationship's going to be, you know, different in these ways. And, you know, and the reality is that in your excitement, you forget that the only consistent thing about us is our inconsistency. And so, you know, my own reprieve from death, you know, I struggled because it pointed out the ways in which I was still very much the same person I had been before I got sick. You know, mm-hmm. that it's incredibly easy for something to become your new normal, and you're back to the old habits, and the things you wish you could change, you know, creep back into your daily life. And that can be, you know, not only disappointing, but, indicting, you know. And so then, like, part of the wisdom, I think, in the context of marriage is just to simply realize that is true, not only of you, but your spouse. You know, that I think when you realize that the only consistent thing about your spouse is their inconsistency, it allows you to have some degree of grace and mercy towards them.
Now mm-hmm. Jason, now you're talking about, you know, that what you saw was that you were still the same person that you were before. What about in a situation like Brenda's question, to where the person who was ill actually became someone that they weren't before, but became someone that sort of brought out a lot of negativity and such, and not only towards their spouse, but towards their friends and such. It sounds like in Brenda's case, going back to becoming who he was before probably would have been an improvement.
Yeah. Or that, I've been a pastor long enough to, I'd bet the house that who she sees is who he was before. Just a different part of him. That's again, that's advice I give couples and married couples all the time, is that, you know, in the book I use the Old Testament story of Jacob, who, you know, falls in love with Rachel, and after much, you know, to do, marries her, and they have a wedding party, and the next morning he wakes up and he realizes he's gone to bed with Leah instead, her sister. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a messed up Old Testament story, but, like, the wisdom in it, I think, is that, you know, every person thinks they're marrying Rachel, but at some point in their marriage, they're going to wake up and it's going to be Leah next to them. And, you know, the truth of that is that every Jacob marries both Rachel and Leah. You just don't get to see them until some point further down the line. And so it's when you say I do, you're saying I do to this whole constellation of people that make up this one person. You know, and part of the, you know, the scary, beautiful act of faith that is marriage is offering up these different selves that you have that maybe you're not even aware of. You know, it's the willingness to have those be made vulnerable. And that can produce a really healthy, beautiful marriage. But it can also, you know, in times of stress, produce, you know, the opposite.
I would like to ask you why escaping death for times makes the I do more difficult. I think you alluded to it already with the answers that we've received, but I'd like to dig into that one a little bit more, Jason.
Yeah, it's, the way I use, when I say living in sin, what I have in mind is, so Martin Luther and St. Paul, the way they understand sin primarily is in terms of expectations accusing us, you know. So if you think of, like, the commandments in scripture, they function primarily to accuse us for what we're not doing. You know, thou shalt, you know, go do this, and the first thing you think of is, well, I'm not actually doing that enough. And so yeah, you know, and so like, our relationships, I think, are the main arena where we feel a certain burden of expectations bearing down on us, either expectations that we have from our family of origin or from the culture or from, you know, romantic comedies and bridal magazines and, you know, our friends' relationships and all of that. And so, you know, in my own case, I thought I needed to have, I placed on myself this expectation that my marriage should merit the miracle we've been given. I needed every moment of our marriage to be meaningful. And of course it wasn't, and trying to make it that was an exhausting endeavor, and it was incredibly unfair to everyone around me. That's the sense in which I'm using it. And part of what the book talks about is just my own journey of kind of being set free to just be ordinary.
You know, Jason, the thought comes to mind, and I realize this is probably a societal question that could take a whole nother show to answer. So I apologize up front, but you know, there was a time, if you go back far enough, in which, I mean, when people got married, they really didn't know each other that well, in the sense that mm-hmm. they might come from the same neighborhood, but they, in most cases, hadn't slept together, and in some cases had had chaperones the whole time, so they probably didn't get a chance to see who they really are, except for when they're around their family. And yet the divorce rate was incredibly low, and we now have a situation in which people, it's acceptable to live together or to do a lot more things. You know, you can pull up people's social media, you can do all these different things to learn so much about them. And yet we have record highs in divorce rate. Can you touch on that? But understanding that I realize it's a big question, but in a relatively short answer.
Yeah, I think if there's any difference between our culture now and that of our predecessors, it's that they entered marriage knowing they didn't really know the person they were marrying. And we enter marriage thinking that we do. Because most of the couples I marry, they're already living together. That's not anything new. And so just because you're having sex with someone doesn't really mean that you know them. And as a consequence, you don't really know yourself either. And I think what maybe is different between our generation and previous generations is, you know, they knew that, and so when they discovered a new facet of their partner, they didn't freak out and run away. And so I think it's when you're naive about, knowing yourself and knowing the other person, that when you discover some part of them that was a mystery to you, it can be threatening. And so I think that's the main difference. I quote this psychologist at UVA in the book, Timothy Wilson, who wrote a book called Strangers to Ourselves. And he talks about, you know, extensively how almost all of us were only conscious of about 13% of the decisions we make. We like to think of ourselves as having this free will and we're actively making all the decisions in our lives. But the reality is we're a mystery to ourselves. In fact, not just our, not just for our spouse.
So, Gabriella?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. I think for the younger ones that I meet, I would say we think we're dispensable. We think a little bit like the human beings are commodities. I see younger people exchange boyfriends like, wow, like there's no tomorrow. Even with my generation, what a difference already. And I just also think it's because we're too interested in the outside of the person than the inside of the person. We are very, very, we talk to them very little. You know that when someone is in love, they spend the whole night awake, sitting in a car talking. How often do you hear that? And that's the most they've talked to each other for the rest of their lives. After that one event, it almost doesn't happen. And I think with the younger people, that doesn't even happen anymore. And that's kind of what I see personally.
Yeah, I think, because my oldest son is 16. And so one of the things I'm aware of is how so much of their relational life is online. And as a consequence, so much of it is filtered through a social media sheen. And so, you know, one of the things that worries me with younger people is, the online world and then even just kind of a culture without mercy that we live in. As soon as you make a mistake online, you're shunned forever. I think young people have less access to be vulnerable with one another than was true in previous times. And I don't think without the permission and the safety and the freedom to be completely naked, quote unquote, marriage, you'd be crazy to get married if you don't have the freedom to be vulnerable before another. Because it's really, and again, not to get too super theological, but as far as the church is concerned, it's bride and groom. It's the two partners being completely vulnerable with each other in the context of joy and trust. That is an image for Father, Son, and Spirit. That's what the wedding liturgy is getting at. And so if you don't have that vulnerability with trust and joy, you don't really have the foundation for a marriage.
I would agree with what you say. I just would like to add that I believe strongly that young and old and in between, everything from I would actually almost say 11 till 75 is actually searching desperately for that vulnerability. And when they see it in another, that's part of my teaching. And when they see it in another, they actually ask me how I have the capacity of doing it, and then without a problem, and then closing the curtain publicly without a problem, opening it and closing it, depending on the moment. And I do it publicly, obviously, in my public speaking. And I see how hungry they are for that. But as long as they stay so scared to be judged, see, I'm not afraid to be judged afterwards. The only one that I'm afraid of that will judge me the most is myself. So, the contender is me, not all the other people that might say, oh, I don't like Gabriella today because she was a little bit off. Do you see what I mean? And so I do see, Jason, how, and I think that's why we see a new conversation about faith much more than we have 20 years ago, because that faith, vulnerability, how do I let go of the mask, is a topic that they all would love to discuss. I mean, even someone of 11, they really want to discuss. They just do not know. They don't have the tools how to open the dialogue. And then if they're giving the tools to open it, then they go, and I'm going to say this a little bit strangely, to smithereens in 50 seconds, right? They're just like, oh my God, what she's going to do with me now that I've told her, And then when they see that nothing happens, that the only thing that happens is pure feeling, then they are so shocked.
Well,
Well, and actually, let me interject with both. First of all, I'm really glad that both of you brought up vulnerability, because I think it's something that isn't touched on enough. And in fact, I was thinking about it just over Independence Day, how, we're really talking about independence. And I chose to share with people that I care about, wishing them equal parts of vulnerability and independence, because I think it's that important. And Jason, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I just want to tell you that I'm so thankful that you could come on with us, but also that you're putting out these books, that you are sharing with people at a time in which sometimes when people are going through, what you're going through, that, they shut down or they don't want to talk about it. And I think that this helps so many people, especially people that are out there that are cancer survivors, that are thinking, you know, I'm going to get through this. There was a time not too many years ago to where people just assumed that it was a very quick death sentence, and there was nothing that they could do. And what I see is you're doing a lot, you're making a difference, and I'm just very thankful that you're doing that.
And may I ask something real quickly, Jason? Are you still at the Methodist Church, United Methodist Church in Virginia?
I'm in a different one, but 5 miles away.
Yes.
It's called Annandale United Methodist Church.
Super. I'll come and look you up on my world tour.
There you go.
Okay.
Actually, yes, I think that's a great idea. And so for those that want to get the book, is it at all normal book places, or is there somewhere in particular that's best for them to be able to get the book for those that want to follow up?
Oh, they can get it everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, that sort of thing. It's linked on my website, which is tamedcynic.org. They can find it there.
All right. And now it's, and again, for those of you that are driving, if you can't, you're not going to be able to write that down, the tamedcynic.org. We will also make sure we have that on our Answers for the Family page. So again, thank you to both of you for coming on. Gabriella, we will talk to you again next week.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jason. Keep up the good work.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we will be joined by Aram Singh to discuss Your Heart, My Hands, An Immigrant's Remarkable Journey to Become One of America's just the absolute best cardiac surgeons. And it is actually quite a remarkable story as I am now reading it. So, and if you get the chance, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, and Spreaker, which it would really be great if you can do that. It also gives you an opportunity to be able to make comments, to help critique what it is we're doing, and let us know if we're doing well. So for everybody out there, please be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.